I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Jake Wood, co-founder of Team Rubicon, an organization that provides disaster relief across the globe, from responding to earthquakes in Haiti to hurricanes in New York City. Team Rubicon is a group of veterans who are applying the skills they used in war zones, such as Iraq and Afghanistan, to disaster situations elsewhere. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
What does Team Rubicon do?
So, you know, Team Rubicon is really focused on taking veterans coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan and finding a way for them to continue to serve. And, you know, what we do is we organize, train, and deploy them for disaster relief. You know, we found a lot of lessons that were learned on the battlefield are applicable in disaster zones, and we feel like there's a lot of synergy there that can, you know, benefit from both sides.
Now, the catalyst for starting the organization was the earthquake in Haiti in January 2010. Where were you at that time?
You know, I had just gotten out of the Marine Corps, and I'd been out of the Marine Corps for about 3 months. I was living in Los Angeles. I'd been stationed in Southern California. That's what took me out there. And I was applying to go to grad school to get my MBA and was sitting on my couch in my apartment in Los Angeles when the earthquake happened. The joke is that I was sitting around in my underwear eating, you know, potato chips when it happened. And there's some truth to that, probably.
Now, you joke about, you know, being alone on your couch eating potato chips, but a lot of the experience of soldiers coming back from war is isolated and lonely. What was your personal experience being back?
Right. I mean, if I was alone eating potato chips on my couch when this happened, it wasn't because I was, you know, isolated and withdrawn socially after having come out of the military. It's not really fair to ask how my experience was coming out because, you know, in 3 months, it's very hard to determine. I got out of the Marine Corps. My then-girlfriend, now wife, and I went to South America for, you know, a month and traveled South America. And I came back and it was the holidays and I was having fun and I was seeing family and friends. And so, you know, early January, I hadn't even thought about life as a civilian yet. And so then I went straight into Team Rubicon. I went straight to Haiti. And, you know, my wife jokes that I really never left, you know, the military. So it's kind of my experience transitioning out has been far from normal.
In a positive sense.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
When she jokes that you really have never left the military, how much of your wanting to go to Haiti was personally driven about, like, wanting to be back where you had been because of the adrenaline rush and the other things that go along with it?
Yeah, I mean, it's really hard to think back to what the emotions were that were going through that day. You know, I've always been the type of person that's wanted to help people. You know, that was one of my motivations for joining the military in the beginning. But, you know, I'd be a liar if I said there wasn't an element of excitement to it. There was a certain level of, you know, the rush. And you know, I still miss that. You know, whenever missions happen, I long for it, you know, and to be where the boots hit the ground.
So you see the earthquake in Haiti and you said, okay, I want to respond. What logistically did you do?
William and I had a couple of initial phone calls about what needed to happen in order to make it a reality.
And by the way, William McNulty, your co-founder.
Correct. Mm-hmm. And so we had a couple of initial conversations. Of course, the first thing we had to do was get down to Haiti, you know, and that was problematic because they shut down the airport and only military planes were coming in and humanitarian designated planes. So we needed to raise money, get to Haiti, and then we needed, you know, shelter, food, and water. I mean, some of the basic necessities of doing anything in life. And so we were able to raise the money initially from social media.
Now, when you say social media, you posted your desire on Facebook?
Yeah, basically, once the decision was made, we put it to Facebook, which I guess, you know, nothing's official these days until it's on Facebook. And within, I'd say, 10 minutes, my future brother-in-law called me and offered to buy 4 round-trip tickets down to the Dominican Republic, which is where we had kind of decided we had to fly in and out of, as you know, because of this restricted airspace in Port-au-Prince. So that kind of made it a reality. We knew we could get, we may not be able to get to C, if C is Port-au-Prince, but we could get to B, which was right next door in the Dominican Republic.
So, and is that a military term, using those letters like that?
No, not at all.
Okay.
But, you know, I'm a big believer in you'll never get anywhere looking for the complete solution. You know, you always have to put yourself closer and closer to the problem, finding those incremental, you know, solutions. And so we knew we could get to the Dominican Republic, and at first we didn't know how we were going to get to the Dominican, from the Dominican to Haiti, but once you start putting those pieces in place, those other solutions, it opens doors. The next thing was, okay, security, and where are we going to lay our head at night? And William went to a Jesuit high school in Chicago. For whatever reason, he thought it'd be a good idea to call someone at his former Jesuit high school. And it turns out it was a good idea. And we got put in touch with the Jesuits who were running a mission down in Port-au-Prince. And so we had a Jesuit brother, Brother Jim, drive from Port-au-Prince across the border and met us in the Santo Domingo, and then escorted us back into Haiti, over land.
So how much planning did you do from your couch in Los Angeles versus just learning by doing once you got down there?
We were probably, from the time we made the decision to go to the time we boarded planes to leave, was about 48 hours. You know, a lot of that was packing supplies and continuing to raise some money and set some of those things in place. And
how many were you?
Well, it started out with four. And en route down to the Dominican, we each recruited another member to the team while we were flying down. So William, for instance, was sitting on the tarmac at Dulles Airport. And a guy leans over and says, "Hey, you look like you're about to go do something crazy in Haiti." And William, you know, was kind of taken aback, but he said, "Yeah, you're right. I'm going down." And he goes, "Oh, I was a former Army Special Forces medic. I've got experience in Haiti working for a security company, and I'm going down there to help myself. Mind if I join?" And so we added that guy, Mark Hayward, and then I added an ER doctor that I met in Santo Domingo at the baggage claim. And it just kind of rolled up from there.
How were you received? Did you ask permission from certain organizations before you went down?
Yeah, so again, William, you know, kept making a lot of pieces fall in place. He was in D.C. when this all was going down, and, you know, in those 48 hours that we were preparing, he just walked up to both the Dominican and the Haitian embassies on Embassy Row and probably oversold what it was that we were doing and capable of, but he got signed letters from both ambassadors to the U.S. guaranteeing, you know, the safe passage across the border and that none of our supplies were to be confiscated or anything like that. And so, yes, technically we were invited and we had these permissions. I think that we probably took advantage of the chaos of the situation a little bit.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Jake Wood, co-founder of Team Rubicon, an organization comprised of former veterans. These volunteers apply their military experience to emergency situations, working as first responders internationally. When did it occur to you that the situation in Haiti resembled the disaster situations, the ambiguity, the human tragedy, the mismanagement that you had experienced out in the field in the war zone?
I mean, from the moment we crossed the border checkpoint was complete chaos. There was really no control happening. You could just pass and go as you saw fit. But as you got closer and closer and closer to Port-au-Prince, the density of suffering just increased. There was just still this dust in the air from all the rubble, and it was literally like a fog, but it was this chalky dust. And you could still hear people crying and wailing, and we were in pickup trucks at that point and moving 6 miles an hour through these streets, people coming up and trying to pull supplies off of the back of your truck. And we were getting in there right at twilight, and so it was about to go dark. We made it to the compound right as the sun went down, and we rolled into this Jesuit compound. They had a guard at the door with a shotgun, and we did a quick perimeter check to see how secure it was, and we bedded down for the night. But shortly after arriving and starting to bed down, one of the doctors that had joined the team was approached, and there was a woman or a little girl with her mother who had an open and compound fracture in her leg, meaning that her femur had broken so badly that the bone was coming out through the skin. And it had been like that, of course, for 4 days. So 20 minutes after arriving, our doctors were doing, basic battlefield surgery almost, and without anesthesia. This poor girl was sitting there, and she was screaming and wailing, and that was kind of a welcome to Port-au-Prince.
You were kind of struck by the similarity in the Middle East, but how much was the fact that your life was not at risk to the same degree part of your experience?
It was interesting. I was in the Marine Corps Infantry for one tour with a rifle squad in Anbar Province, Iraq, during the surge. Saw the full range of kinetic activity that a Marine rifle squad can experience. My second tour, I was a scout sniper on a sniper team in Helmand Province, Afghanistan, which was the most volatile area of Afghanistan for the last, really, for the last 4 years. So I'd been in danger. You know, I'd been in mortal danger for pretty much the prior 4 years of my life. So it was interesting to be in an area where there was so much need for help and a similar need and in many ways similar, you know, sensory activity with smells and sights and sounds and all of that, but not having to feel like there was an ambush around every corner. I mean, there was danger. There's a lot of criminal activity in Port-au-Prince. It's a very dangerous city. Nobody's going there for holidays, but I mean, it was relieving. I think my friend Clay kind of said it best. He talked about how it was renewed his sense of humanity a little bit. You know, even in a place like Port-au-Prince, which on a normal day is pretty dangerous, you know, the worst catastrophe in modern history befalls them and they become more human. They're helping one another. They're putting down grudges and longstanding rivalries to help dig each other out or provide water and food for one another. And we're gracious to our help.
By the way, William, your co-founder, William McNulty, how did you meet him?
Hey, we always joke about how it was kind of like Match.com. You know, we had been put in touch with one another about a year prior to the earthquake. We had never met, kind of had a mutual acquaintance who thought that we kind of thought alike. You know, we had only had some cursory conversations prior to Haiti. So Santo Domingo, Dominican, was the first time we ever shook hands.
Yet he was the first person you called to want to get down there.
Well, he actually called me. So it's kind of a funny story. I went through, initially I called all the guys that had been in my sniper team in Afghanistan. And either they hadn't yet figured out that there was an earthquake that hit Port-au-Prince, or they didn't have a passport. Mm-hmm. The irony of being able to deploy to Iraq and Afghanistan is you don't need a passport. I was dumbfounded that they either didn't know what was going on and I had to yell at them to turn on the TV and turn it to CNN for once in their lives, or they didn't have a passport. Actually, the first person I got a hold of was my college roommate, who was the firefighter up in Wisconsin. He didn't hesitate to say that you know, he was willing to go. And then after I put it on Facebook, I got a call from William.
Isn't it interesting how, you know, these accidents happen?
Right.
The accident of your co-founding Team Rubicon was through, you know, an introduction by a friend.
Right. Yeah. And sometimes you can't discount some of those, you know, those minor events that happen. You know, one of our mantras early at TR was to, you know, never say no, you know, say yes to everything, because you never know who's going to play out and help or be a critical, you know, component of the team moving forward.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Jake Wood, co-founder of Team Rubicon. We'll hear more from Jake coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Jake Wood, co-founder of Team Rubicon, an organization comprised of former veterans. These volunteers apply their military experience to emergency situations, working as first responders internationally. And by the way, the organization now is comprised of not just veterans, but other volunteers. Is that correct?
Yeah, so we have about 80% of our volunteers are veterans. The other 20 are a lot of firefighters, you know, some doctors and medics and first responders, and you know, a few well-meaning civilians slip in as well.
At what point did you decide to formalize or institutionalize the organization after Haiti?
You know, the whole story is just really funny. We had no intention of starting an organization when we went down to Haiti. We just wanted to go and help. We thought it was something that we'd, you know, tell at the bar, you know, as a one-upper story for the rest of our lives. But, you know, while we were down there, we started to see the impact we could have. But I still don't think it really hit us. But, you know, we had kind of a sensationalist story, this group of military veterans running around Port-au-Prince, you know, outside the big UN cluster system. And providing a lot of real meaningful aid in a very transparent way and using social media to tell that story. So we started to get this really large following online out of nowhere overnight. And that propelled a lot of money to come in. And so my dad took a week off of work. He's you know, the vice president of manufacturing for a, you know, small factory up in Iowa. And he was running our command operations center from our house in Iowa.
What's his name?
Jeff Wood. So we were raising this money, and I'd have a weekly or a nightly or every other night phone call with my dad to check in and see, okay, hey, we have more teams coming down from Chicago. They're arriving at noon tomorrow. We have these pieces coming in from Miami and supplies coming in from Pittsburgh. And there was a lot of moving pieces that really, you know, snowballed. And one night my dad called me, and we kind of went through the general brief that we'd been going through. And then he said, oh, by the way, I got a phone call from a lawyer who was a former Marine up in Minnesota, and he just incorporated you today as a 501c3. And I said, Dad, what the hell is a 501c3? I had no idea. And he said, it's a nonprofit organization, and you're the president. I said, well, that's not in the plan. Why? And he said, well, because of all the money that's been raised, it was through my personal PayPal account. And I was going to be liable for taxes and all these things. And so the IRS, to their credit, did a great job of realizing that this was such an out of the ordinary event that they were very good about allowing organizations that kind of popped up to, you know, retroactively give charitable credit for donations that came in before those 501c3 paperwork was established. So, I mean, the IRS actually did a really good job post Haiti of being flexible, yeah, which they're not exactly known for. So that's how we found ourselves, William and I, on the board of directors for a nonprofit that didn't exist, you know, 12 hours before the Haiti earthquake.
And how did you come to the name?
Right before we pushed out to Port-au-Prince, William called me and said, I think we should give this a name. It's starting to get a little traction, and Marines always want to name everything that they do. So we started bouncing it back and forth, but the Rubicon was a river that separated ancient Rome and Gaul, and Roman legions weren't allowed to cross it because it was considered an act of war. Crossing the Rubicon has come to mean the point of no return, or crossing to the point of no return. And there's a river that separates part of the Dominican from Haiti as a border. And so we kind of treated that border crossing as our Rubicon. There were no longer any excuses. There were a ton of excuses for us not to go all along the way that people were telling us, all these reasons. But we knew that as soon as we crossed that border, we were going to be committed.
By the way, you mentioned before that one of your mantras or rules was never say no.
Yeah.
Generally.
Yeah, I mean, that more had to do with, like, meeting people and you know, take this meeting or meet that person for coffee, even if it didn't seem to make sense. We say no a lot, just to get that clear.
And so how is that applied in your personal life? Do you tend to have a posture of openness?
Yeah. You know, I've always been a really forward-leaning person. You know, a lot of people, they find reasons not to do something, or they see obstacles instead of opportunities. And we took this position of we will meet with every single person that we can. And it doesn't matter if they're, you know, selling, you know, pink lemonade in Philadelphia, if they ask us to go out for coffee, we're going to do it.
We talk about the Rubicon and you're having a forward-leaning posture. What for you was the reason to go into a life in the military? You don't have family in the military.
I'd always been interested in the military in high school and was thinking about joining then. And turned out I was a decent high school football player. And so I started getting a lot of scholarship opportunities to go and play college football. And that shifted my priorities a little bit, and I wanted to go be a pro football player. And so
you went to the University of Wisconsin.
Yeah, so I ended up taking a full scholarship to University of Wisconsin instead of you know, going to either a military academy or just joining the Marines right out of high school, which had always kind of been a plan of mine. And so I went to college fall of 2001, and 6 weeks in or 4 weeks into college freshman classes, 9/11 happened. I thought about dropping out, you know, a month into college and joining. I didn't. I made excuses not to go. And over the course of the next 2 years, my college career didn't pan out from a football perspective like I'd hoped. And then going into my senior year, Pat Tillman was killed in Afghanistan, who had been a pro football player that walked away from $9 million to join the Army. That profoundly impacted my life. And so I made the decision the day I saw the ticker come across the screen that he'd been killed, that I was going to join.
And here's somebody who played football in college and who sold life insurance one summer.
Me?
Right? Yeah.
How the hell did you know that? that actually paid enormous dividends.
Tell me how selling life insurance paid enormous dividends.
You know, there is not a harder sales gig in the world than selling life insurance. But it's paid a lot of dividends.
Why do you keep saying that? Why?
Well, I mean, my whole it's equally difficult to try to get people to invest in a startup nonprofit where they're never going to see their money come back. And that's really what we were. In essence, I had to go to angel investors and say, hey, write me a check for $50,000 for this idea called Team Rubicon. The only promise I have is that you'll never see your money again. You know, even in the social sector, foundations are not quick to write checks to organizations less than 3 years old. And a lot of them, you know, saw Team Rubicon as a flash in the pan, one-hit wonder from Haiti, and didn't think that we'd 50 missions later be, you know, still kicking ass. So.
You mentioned before your friend Clay. You were his best man at his wedding. He was a former Marine. Mm-hmm. And after the war, he took his life in 2011 due to this difficult transition to civilian life. And there's a quote he said, "Marines are at war and Americans are at the mall." Mm-hmm. To what extent is Team Rubicon a place for former veterans to go to have a sense of purpose, to be able to make themselves useful?
Yeah, I mean, that's really what it's all about now. Over the first year, we thought the organization was just going to be a disaster response organization. But what we saw was that these veterans who were participating in that were coming home and saying that it was, you know, the most valuable experience that they'd had since they took off their uniform. And concurrent to that, we had a lot of veterans who were asking to get involved with Team Rubicon who, for whatever reason, they didn't have the necessary skill set to go, say, and train medics in Burma, you know, along the Thai-Burma border. Maybe they were a truck driver in the military or a nuclear biochemical specialist in the Navy, and we just didn't need that. But they were expressing this desire to be a part of something again. And so, you know, right around this time is when Clay killed himself, and we realized that there was this opportunity for us to become more than just a disaster response organization, but to be an organization that provides purpose and community and, you know, identity for veterans who are longing for that.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Jake Wood, co-founder of Team Rubicon, an organization comprised of former veterans. These volunteers apply their military experience to emergency situations, working as first responders internationally. There's a company called Palantir, which addresses big data mm-hmm. and helping organizations and companies sift through just large information. How are you using Palantir at Team Rubicon?
Yeah, so Palantir is actually one of those just never say no stories. I was speaking at an event in San Diego, and after the event, I got approached by this guy named Brian Fishman, who worked on their philanthropy team, and he approached me, reached out, shook my hand, said great talk. And anyway, we have a great talk. The guy's very genuine, and over the course of the next 4 weeks, we had some, you know, some just high-level discussions about what Palantir might do for us, and I just still didn't get it. Mm. Then Hurricane Sandy happened, maybe a month and a half after we had met, and he calls me, and he just keeps calling me and calling me three times a day during the first 5 days of that response, and I'm actually pretty frustrated that he's continuing to bother me, and he just keeps saying, like, let us go to New York, and I'll show you what we can do. And I said, fly to JFK, be there by 9 p.m., I'll have a van pick you up, bring all the equipment you need, don't screw it up, you know, or something like that. And he showed up, and, you know, when they land and they show up at our forward operating base, I get a phone call from our team leader on the ground. He goes, who are these geeks? And he didn't get it either. And, you know, listen, fast forward 48 hours, Brian Fishman and this team of engineers from Palantir start making us look like the smartest guys in the room. And it's only because we just didn't say no, although we were tempted to.
So what exactly do they do?
I didn't even get to the question. So we will go into a disaster zone with a bunch of mobile devices. So we send out these assessment teams immediately after a tornado, say. And they go street by street, house by house, and they are inputting information into this mobile device. So we might go through a neighborhood, two different neighborhoods, and one has suffered catastrophic damage and one has suffered medium-scale damage, but both are uninhabitable. You might say that go after the catastrophic damage first because it's worse damage. It's going to take more work. But if we layer in, say, U.S. Census data, which Palantir can do, and then heat map the levels of damage against, say, elderly populations or poverty levels, then we can say, well, actually, although the damage is less significant over here in this neighborhood, this is a more vulnerable population, so we need to pour resources here first because they're not going to be able to get back onto their feet as easy. This will bankrupt them if they don't come in and get free yet professional labor.
I want to shift to your personal life. You mentioned that you grew up in Iowa.
Mm-hmm.
Your father is a vice president at a manufacturing company.
Mm-hmm.
What does he manufacture?
They manufacture laboratory equipment, specifically calorimeters, so devices that measure energy output. So you put, like, say, food in it, and you put it, make it, you pump oxygen, and then you burn it, and it measures the caloric output of it.
Caloric.
Caloric, no. Like calories.
And your mom?
My mom's been a stay-at-home mom my whole life. I've been very lucky.
How many siblings do you have?
I've got three sisters, two older and one younger.
What was your family's response when you told them that you wanted to go into the military, into the Marines?
They were devastated. Take, for instance, my dad. I think he was, to be blunt, I think he was a little pissed off. I certainly know now he understands.
What has surprised you about your Team Rubicon experience, like running the organization? And also, what has surprised you about your experience just like being out there on the ground?
Boy, there's a couple things that jump out at me. I think on the international side, there's this aversion to anything not humanitarian. And so that means that there are all these humanitarian organizations that that loathe Team Rubicon because of our military roots. Mm-hmm. They have a natural mistrust of the military. And coupled with that, you know, there's a lot of business practices, best practices that just, for whatever reason, whether they have the same poor opinion of big business, but they just refuse to adopt. And you would think that there would be, you know, just simple things like the adoption of universal cloud computing platforms that would enable a cluster in Manila and a cluster in Tacloban to have access to the same information in real time. But there isn't. And it's and you have these people that are handing in paper forms with information on different formats that get taken in, and then nothing happens with it. Nobody collates it. Nobody uploads it to the cloud for universal access. Nobody's certainly mapping it geospatially. And these are things that the military has been doing for years. These are simple, you know, SaaS platforms that any business can have access to for $10 a month.
SaaS being software and as a service.
Right.
Yep.
So that's one of the things that kind of shocks me, just this mistrust that's placed at both at corporate America and at the military for possibly having, you know, useful ideas that can help improve what's happening. Drilling down to kind of a boots on the ground perspective, I think one of the things that frustrates me is that there's this instant fear of what the security situation on the ground is. There's always this assumption made that if it's a country that's, you know, non-Western, civil society is going to be suspended and they're going to be clawing at each other's eyes. In the Philippines, for instance, you know, the health cluster run by the World Health Organization was, you know, directing people to set up these static clinics, you know, at like this community center or this school gymnasium. Well, that's great. But if you had your leg broken in a massive typhoon, you're not going to walk 3 miles to a community center to be seen. And the reason they were directing people to start these static clinics is they could put security at them. And we've always seen that you have to be mobile and move out into the community in order to get them the aid that they need. So the concern should always be there. Don't get me wrong. We're always concerned about safety. But we don't misinterpret desperate, starving people as security threats. We think that they're just simply desperate, starving people.
Now that you are deeply embedded in Team Rubicon and you're back in civil society, how does your experience having been in the Marines and now helping with disaster situations elsewhere impact even just your quotidian life? How often do you use your experiences there as references for the way you go about your day?
Yeah, I find myself doing that all the time. You know, hopefully my wife doesn't listen to this podcast, but I eat, sleep, and breathe, you know, Team Rubicon, except for when I'm with you, Indra. Love you. But, you know, I lean on the things I learned in the military all the time. You know, I have no formal training in entrepreneurship. I have a business degree as an undergrad, but we all know that's kind of a joke. And, you know, the ideas of how to formulate plans and objectives and you know, formulating strategy but focusing on tactics. And, you know, at the end of the day, I think the one thing that most Marines, and I can really only speak to the Marine Corps, get out of their service in the Marine Corps is this attitude. this attitude of mission accomplishment and overcoming odds to, you know, to achieve objectives.
You mentioned your wife. She has not been to the places you've been. How often are you referring to your time in the military when you are together, and how does she feel about
it? It's interesting, you know, because of my experiences in the military, I look at things much more objectively. Everyday life situations present themselves. I often can revert to this, you know, perhaps cold calculus of what needs to happen. You know, if you're told in the Marine Corps that you need to storm that trench that has two machine guns in it that's firing at you, you approach that mission with the objective knowledge that you're probably going to lose some men in the attempt. And, you know, in civilian life, we would just say, well, you know what, the trench isn't worth taking. There can be simple things that pop up in life where I my wife tells me I need to look at these much with more subjectivity or empathy, and she'll usually, you know, smack me in the arm and tell me to snap out of it and stop being Sergeant Wood and be Jake. So it happens.
I feel like you're not robotic, but your very tough stance when you first met me has sort of melted away a little bit now. And now I see, oh, this was like Jake pre-military.
Was I asking Jake when I walked in?
You weren't Jake, but you were no-nonsense Jake. And that's fine. But it's nice to see how your posture has gotten softer over the course of this interview, which is natural in general.
I know it's something I need to work on. Everybody tells me I have a scowl. So I need to work on my scowl. That's what I got in my 360 feedback interviews from people.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
My guest has been Jake Wood. Coming up, we'll meet Elizabeth Cutler and Julie Rice, co-founders of SoulCycle, a company that offers indoor cycling classes. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guests are Elizabeth Cutler and Julie Rice, co-founders of SoulCycle, a company that offers indoor cycling classes through the New York metro region, Long Island, and Los Angeles. Elizabeth and Julie opened their first studio in 2006 on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, and the company has grown rapidly in popularity, attracting clients like Chelsea Clinton, Conan O'Brien, Katie Couric, and Kelly Ripa. SoulCycle classes are 45 minutes long and claim to be a full-body workout. Welcome.
Thank you for having us.
So you are both unlikely people to start an exercise company. Tell me a little bit about your background. Why don't we start with you, Elizabeth?
I grew up in Chicago. I was not one of those kids who was really into sports. And I lived in Colorado for 14 years. And when I was living in Colorado, I got into hiking in particular, which is a great form of cardio. And when I moved back to New York, I met my husband, and I did yoga also. And I continued to do that. And after our children were born, I put on a lot of weight when I was pregnant. And my mother, who I adore, told me, oh, you know, don't worry about what you eat. I wore my jeans home from the hospital. And sadly enough, that was not my experience whatsoever. And about 6 weeks after our first daughter was born, I still had 45 pounds to go. And one of my dearest friends just said to me, you have got to get some cardio. And I was so intimidated. I was afraid. And I went to take a class. And a light really went off for me. I really felt like if I could access this, then so many people who feel like they can't do cardio could access this, and it could really change something for them, because everybody needs cardio and most people hate it.
Now, this was an indoor cycling class. Can you explain what a spin class or an indoor cycling class is for those who have never taken one?
At SoulCycle, we ride on indoor cycling bikes, and we have pedals that people use specific bike shoes to clip into. And what's great about that is that you're using your entire leg. But so basically what it is it's riding inside on a stationary bike in a class that's set to music and led by a teacher.
Elizabeth, you sold real estate in Colorado when you were living there.
I was. I had grown up in a real estate family. My mother was a very successful real estate broker in Chicago. And ended up moving to Telluride. And while I was there, I got introduced to an arm of Oriental medicine called Jinshin Jitsu. So because of the lifestyle that exists in Colorado, I was able to do both, but just wasn't really the money that I would need to sort of live my life.
So you moved to New York City and you discovered indoor cycling. At what point did you say, you know what, this would be an interesting business to start?
You know, my sister-in-law owns Bikram Yoga, is a co-owner of Bikram Yoga here in the city. And so she was, I said to her, you know, I'm feeling this urge to do this. I mean, I had a five-month-old and a three-year-old. And she was really encouraging.
And how about you, Julie? You were a talent manager in Los Angeles.
I was in L.A. for about 9 years. And not unlike Elizabeth, I sort of had, you know, an aha moment on a bike. I've always been sort of athletic, but it's never really had a joyful effect on me before. I thought to myself, I get it. I understand why this can be something that's not just, you know, checking off, you know, exercise today on my to-do list.
What's an example of the impact that SoulCycle has had, not necessarily just physically?
Our experience now over and over again is people coming up to us and saying, you know, I don't go to my therapist anymore because I do it on the bike. Or I literally walked into the Upper East Side studio the other day and a woman came up to me and she said, I want you to know that you saved my life. She said, I just had a baby and I started working out here right after, you know, my child was born and you really saved my life. And I said to her, I'm so glad to hear it. You look amazing. How old is your child? And she said, oh, my baby is 5 months old, but that's not at all what I'm talking about. She explained that it really helped her connect to her child and back to herself and to her family. For us, the surprise gift in this business has been the emotional release that it has given to people.
When you noticed the benefits of doing a spin class, why did you necessarily say, I'd like to start a business? Where did that come from?
Truth be told, I sort of looked high and low for an experience that would make me feel like what I had found in my, you know, little indoor cycling studio in Los Angeles. I tried every indoor cycling class in New York City, and I just could not find it.
Was there also some unhappiness with your current work environment that kind of gave you the extra push to say, you know what, I'd like something new?
Definitely. Well, one thing that Elizabeth and I have very much in common were we both started the business when we had babies that were 5 months old. After I had my daughter, I definitely was feeling like I would like to figure out a job where I could work on my own terms.
So you both had this idea in isolation. How did you ultimately meet each other?
We met at a lunch. We were introduced and we started to talk.
By a mutual friend.
Yes. And slowly but surely, we started to talk about the ideas that we had for creating an indoor cycling business. I like this about this place, but I think this could be better. Or wouldn't it be great if you could do some upper body work in the 45 minutes? Or could you imagine if
we had a reservation system?
Right. Or it was a chic environment. Mm-hmm. Or all the teachers spoke the same language, so you didn't go to, you know, Joe's class at 10 in the morning and it was boot camp, and,
right,
you know, Bill's class at 10 o'clock in the evening and it was, you know, Zen cycle. We always say it was the best blind date we ever went on.
Have you looked at some studies that show the benefits of group exercise versus exercising on your own, for example?
If you drew a chart, you would probably see that the workout for a group of people is more consistent than one person working out by themselves. If you are out there on the West Side Highway running by yourself, on a low day you might run a little slower, and on a fast day you might run a little faster, but probably you are working at a pretty hard level if you are in a class at SoulCycle, because the group is going to carry you with them.
Incidentally, indoor cycling classes take place in the dark. Where did that come from?
For us, we do ride in candlelight, and it sort of sets the tone of a respectful room, a place where people, are there for the right reasons. We have this site on our page on our site called Soul Etiquette, which is just about, you know, how we treat each other. I mean, we really treat it as a sanctuary.
I noticed the music plays such a prominent role. Can you talk to a little bit about the music and really, there's a DJ component to it.
Absolutely. Our instructors spend a lot of time creating their playlists. You know, there's a musical arc that follows the emotional arc, that follows the physical arc.
We have a place on the site where we put our 10 favorite songs of the month. We went through a real phase, and I think it's a classic. We'll always love the Alicia Keys and Empire State of Mind.
Jay-Z. I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guests are Elizabeth Cutler and Julie Rice, co-founders of SoulCycle, a group of indoor cycling studios in New York City, the Hamptons, and Los Angeles. So I want to switch to the nuts and bolts of how you started your business. So you had this excellent first date where you said, okay, I want to get started. So what were the first steps that you took?
Elizabeth started looking for spaces.
We were combing Manhattan. We weren't coming up with much. I mean, people don't really want to rent to, especially at that time in 2006, to people who have no track record whatsoever. So we managed to find a sublet in the back of a lobby on 72nd Street. Great located, very well located on Craigslist. And we thought there was going to be a sign. And then just as we went to go sign the lease, they said, oh, I'm very sorry, but you don't have a sign and you're never going to have one. And if you would like to have one, it'll be inside the lobby on your door. So we did a lot of guerrilla marketing. We got a rickshaw, which we painted. We painted it silver and yellow, which are two colors that we use. And we parked it out in front of the studio and locked it up, hoping that it wouldn't get stolen or ticketed. And we'd say, oh, should we spend another $65 on the ticket for this night so that people know where we are?
Well, we literally used to get a ticket every day from the community board for parking our rickshaw outside. And we parked out there for a long time until finally
stolen.
The community board wanted to actually see us.
Right. And then it got stolen. It was sort of a happy accident.
And how long did it take you from your first meeting to opening the doors on the first day?
4 months.
Yeah.
Quick.
Quick. After our first meeting, Elizabeth started looking for space immediately. And, you know, we didn't even know each other very well. So I was still working at my full-time job. And we would sort of talk in the morning and make our separate to-do lists. And I would schedule my lunch break. So, you know, I was representing models at the time. And, you know, I would sort of be creating shampoo deals and stuff. And then during lunch, I would meet the towel guy downstairs. We really just sat down and made a list. Things you need for cycling: water, bikes, shoes, a space. Elizabeth went to IKEA and created most of our first studio out of IKEA cabinetry. Our front desk and our original studio is from good old IKEA.
And Elizabeth, you were also an investor in the beverage company Izzy, which was ultimately sold to Pepsi. How did you come to be one of the early investors in Izzy?
My best friend from college and her husband, who I grew up down the street from, happened to get married, and they started this company after their first daughter was born. We had seen it in Colorado, and, you know, I said to my husband, I said, well, I think we should put some money in it, and I called Todd, and he said, I cannot take your money. I'm going to lose it. I really cannot do this. And I said, okay, I completely understand, but I'm an adult, and if you change your mind, let me know. And 2 days later, he called, and he said, we just got a huge order from Whole Foods. It's our first big order, and we have no money to fill the order, so we will be glad to take your check. And then it was really just a really amazing, happy coincidence. I mean, we had the money to do what we needed to do. Sort of, it was extremely timely. The business was pretty successful from the beginning, but it just took the pressure off us in terms of, you know, paying back investors.
So were you the sole investor initially for the company?
Yes, I was.
So tell me a little more about the logistics of getting the business off the ground. What are some other kind of surprises that, you know, didn't go the way that you had hoped initially?
Well, we put a lot of time into developing an online reservation system. So we would open the reservation system noon on Mondays. The bikes would open for the week and you could just sign up for the classes that you wanted. And we got to a point in the business where things got, as we started to add classes to the studio, things got really busy. And so the system would crash at noon on Monday, which is like the last thing in the world that you want to happen because you make people so mad. We really had to work through the technology of that.
We didn't know a lot about soundproofing in the beginning. Or how close people live to a building that you're playing music in.
Did you get complaints from neighbors or?
Oh, neighbors, other tenants, landlords. It was one of those. And it was like we threw every expensive Band-Aid on the ceiling that we could.
Well, we had hired a contractor at the behest of our broker who said he knew about soundproofing because he did porn studios in Midtown. And so we thought, well, these people really know what they're doing. And when it came right down to it, that technology did not work at all. We were so horrified because we thought we were doing good.
I will say on a larger scale, you know, we really, when we created this business, we actually created a very atypical model, which I think for us was probably one of the biggest obstacles in the beginning. New York had not really yet adopted the concept of boutique fitness, meaning a pay-per-class model, a pay-per-class cardio model. It's one of those things where you pay your money, you know, on a monthly membership to a gym, and you can take spin class. And so it's always a throw-in, a gimme. So I would say that for the first, you know, 6 months, a year, I mean, it was just a barrage of phone calls all day where you'd pick up the phone and the person on the other end would say, this is included in my membership. Why would I pay you for something that I already get for free? They were sort of outraged, actually.
You should tell that story about your father.
Oh, well, I remember showing my dad the first studio and he walked in and he looked around and he looked for the showers and he couldn't find them. And he came a couple months after we'd been open and he looked at me and he said, people really come here? And I said, yeah, people really come here and the people that come here really like it. And I could just see him looking at my mother. Desperately afraid that we were not going to be able to send our child to college. The real truth is that they're a room with bikes in them.
And you showed him.
Yeah. Sort of.
He's Dad. Impressed now. He is impressed. It's very sweet to see how proud he is of Julie.
Given that this was, to some extent, a lifestyle change for both of you, given that you both had five-month-olds, did you have ambition to open up more than one studio, or did kind of success just create the inertia to get you to expansion mode?
Well, in the beginning, we thought if we had one great studio, that was...
Or maybe three.
But. That was really... I mean, but we really, you know, we had a certain number of riders and we thought, oh my goodness, if we could get 50 people here every day, this would just be it. Imagine the feeling of the first morning that, you know, we opened the door and there was a full class. I mean, I can vividly remember the feeling of the first person that did not get a bike in a class.
And when did that happen?
I mean, that was maybe 3 or 4 or 5 months in.
Was there a catalyst? Meaning, what were those turning points, either in people or press, that really helped escalate your success?
Well, it's funny that you say that because when we first opened the studio, I lived across the street. My husband and my daughter and I lived in a tiny rent-controlled apartment that we were busting at the seams growing out of. But on Sundays, I would, you know, sort of, you know, feed Phoebe her bottle and then say, oops, got to go put the garbage out. Tomorrow morning, the garbage guys are coming, you know, or maybe they left the candles burning from the last class. I should go check. I mean, it was that kind of a hands-on. We did everything. And I remember that when our first articles would come out, I would say to Elizabeth, the New York Times is coming out tomorrow. I'm going to get to the studio at 5 a.m. because I can imagine what the phone calls are going to be like, you know, beg my husband, can you watch the baby this morning? And we would sit there. And maybe if we got 1 or 2 phone calls the whole day. I mean, it was no more or no less than any other day at SoulCycle in the beginning. We had a perfect storm sort of a little bit into our business, and this is kind of what it was. The viral marketing started to pick up, and people started to come. And people
really brought their friends. I mean, it was like that commercial, the hair commercial. And the,
you know, I told a friend, and they told two friends,
and so on and so on and so on, and it really was like that.
Then a bunch of press did come out, and then we opened a studio in Bridgehampton. So many people go out to vacation out in the Hamptons in the summer, and we thought it would be a really great way to spread the word. And it was really that fall, after that summer, that our business really started to pop.
And any kind of one celebrity that happened to come in that caused kind of a wave effect?
It was Bill Clinton. We did a fundraiser. when Hillary was running for president, and we decided to raise money for Hillary's campaign. And it was
through a rider.
It was through a rider. And she helped us to get President Clinton there.
He didn't ride.
He didn't ride. But he came and he spoke about
healthcare.
And then we did a ride with what we assumed were going to be would have been his favorite songs if he had actually rode the bike. You know what? It was a slow news day, and everyone came. There was nothing else going on in the world except that President Clinton was speaking at SoulCycle. And I remember, and this was great, we called a company that did billboards on Fifth Avenue. And we begged them to stay up all night and make a wrap for the front doors of SoulCycle because we had no sign. And we knew that news crews would be outside wanting to shoot President Clinton going in because nobody could get inside the event. And so we had them create a facade that covered the entire doors so that when you pulled it open, it was a big wheel. Mm-hmm. And sure enough, I mean, our logo made it all over the news. It was on Entertainment Tonight, and it was on the New York Times and the Daily News. And it was really a big, big thing for us.
Yeah. Thank you both very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jessica.
Nice to be here.
My guests have been Elizabeth Cutler and Julie Rice, co-founders of SoulCycle. If you'd like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at fromscratchradio.org or follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch.